Country Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events throughout our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thanks for listening. In the first part of today's show, we'll be following up on stories that began last week about Zering, the town by Dakin's Lake, and one about the Iowa Wildlife Center, which is being built at the Ledger State Park with the help of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. We'll end with stories about some of the most beautiful species on the insect kingdom, butterflies. But let's get started. We have Martin Hare, the mayor of Zering, on the phone from City Hall in Zering. Welcome, Mayor Hare.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here with us today. My recent visit to Zering was just to drive past and see what a big school you had when I was on my way to Dakin's Lake. But I have since learned there's quite a bit more to Zering than I knew. So I hope you'll tell us all about that.
Zering was established officially in 1881, and it basically was established as a rural farming established community that the railroad came through, and that basically was the means of transportation. And since then, it has been a farming community and has grown. The population of Zering stands around 550 at this time, and it's been in that area for some years. It goes up a little, down a little, and so when we've tried to keep a main street going, we think we have, for a small community, a fairly active main street with a convenience store, service station. We're very fortunate we have a medical clinic here and a NuCara pharmacy, post office, bank, and we're refurbishing one of the old brick buildings on Main Street into two apartments upstairs and then two business areas downstairs. And we have car wash in town. So we feel like we've got a pretty active Main Street for a small community.
I think I saw something also about a library and history center.
Yes, there's a library and a heritage room also on Main Street, and our library is well noted around the area, and we're very proud of our library that we try to have that and keep that going. And we have an active fire department, and at this time we're doing some upgrading with the fire station on the outside, and then we'll be doing some work on the inside to that through the course of the winter.
And you originally were a railroad town. Do you still have a train running through, or is that rails to trails now?
That railroad has stopped several years ago, and part of that ground that was the railroad is what's coming to Zering as part of the Prairie Rail Trail. And that's supposedly they're supposed to work on that yet this fall, and that uses part of that railroad ground. But we haven't had a railroad in town for I'm going to say at least 30-35 years.
Well, of course, like most towns of your size, you're part of a consolidated school district, and I've always wondered about the name of that. It's Colo-Nesco. And what is Nesco, and how did that come about?
Well, when I started in school, it was Zering Consolidated School, and then in 1960, Zering and McCallsburg, which is 4 miles west, consolidated into the school district we call Nesco, which was Northeast Story County. And we were the Nesco School District for many years. And then in the early 80s, Nesco started out as a sharing program with Colo, and then we ended up consolidating, so we are now the Colo-Nesco School District.
And You said in the early 80s. That date rings a bell for me because one of the things that I started to look at when I was thinking about covering Zering today was the fact that you used to have a Labor Day festival. And, you know, we like to cover festivals throughout the summer, and we don't have anything for Labor Day because, of course, a lot of the action in some parts of the state is going to focus around the Iowa State game on that Saturday. But you used to have an active Labor Day festival, and but it stopped in around 1980, according to your website. You've lived there for a long time, so you may remember that festival. Can you tell us anything about why it changed, why you stopped? And I guess you started again, but that's another story.
The times that I was growing up as a young person and in high school, we had a Labor Day. It was not necessarily a Zering Day celebration at that time. It was a Labor Day parade. And on Labor Day, we had a parade and then a horse show. And at that time, there was a sanctioned horse group that went around and had shows throughout the summer, and they accumulated points on how they did. They had show horses and carts and wagons and barrel racing and so forth. And the gentleman here in the Zering area, Dick Sparrow, kind of got that started. And we had a parade, and then a horse show started that afternoon, and sometimes that show would run till 10, 11 o'clock at night because it was the last sanctioned horse show for this group of the year, so they were trying to all be here and get more points to go higher in the standing. And that faded out, and through the years, and around 1980, you're correct, there that it became non-existent. And then so we didn't have anything, but in 1999, there was a small group of people that wanted to have a Zering Days celebration. So the first one was in 1999, and they decided to have that celebration on the last weekend in July. And it's been going ever since. It has grown from just a very small, basically about one day celebration, to now we have actually Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday. And it starts Friday evening. And we have many, many different activities. I think this year there was between 30 and 35 different activities through the 3 days. So that's how it kind of died off, and then it got restarted.
Do you still have a horse show?
No, we do not have a horse show. As you know, that died off with, I guess, horses becoming less popular and the new era, but that sanctioned group, that group just kind of fell apart, and that kind of ended the horse show back then.
Well, I read about something, and you mentioned something pretty amazing. Dick Sparrow also had a 40-horse hitch.
Yes, and he had that for several years, and he was the only 40-horse hitch around at that time, and in 1971 and 72, he brought the 40-horse hitch to town. Our Labor Day parade was still in operation then, and he brought the 40-horse hitch into Zering. Dick Sparrow lived just southeast of Zering out in the country. And they estimate there was between 40 and 50,000 people in town each year, the 2 years he brought that to town.
When you told me about it, you said it was an ordeal.
Yes, it was an ordeal. We had cars parked in a town the size of Zering. To put 40 to 50,000 people in town, there were people on rooftops and along the streets and cars parked out in the country in the fields that came back. I mean, it was a large deal for the city of Ziering those 2 years.
From what I read, he went to bigger places where they could accommodate bigger crowds more easily.
Yes.
He went to Chicago and
yes. He went to Chicago, I know, and he would go to Milwaukee with his 40 horse team, and it seems to me he went to Denver. I can't remember all, but he would have quite a crew, and it was quite a caravan to take this hitch, and he would go in parades in these larger cities.
That's an unusual claim to fame. So Ziering must have been even smaller then.
As far as the actual population in the community, it might have been, but back in those years, we had much more population in the rural area, of course, because you had many more farmers and families out in the rural area that also supported the town, but they didn't live in town.
Right, right. I know that in the story of the consolidation of schools, there were schools, you know, that went down to like four students in the graduating class, and
mm-hmm.
and they used to have, you know, families with 10 children
mm-hmm.
populating the schools, so that
mm-hmm.
That was where their school population dropped.
Sure, and that's been the history of many of the smaller farming communities. As the farmers become fewer and the families drop off in the rural areas, it does affect the community.
I noticed from your website that you have a number of sports fields, and you have an active soccer team that's in the soccer league. Is that right?
That's correct. We have a soccer field on the north side of town, and we have the Manfred Schuler Little League ball field on the east end of town, which has a baseball diamond and a softball diamond for our younger youth groups that play baseball and softball. And then we have the high school baseball field up at the school. And so, yes, we do. And we have quite a sports program for our young people here in the community and the surrounding area for baseball, softball, soccer. And so, we feel like we have a very nice ball field down here for them.
Well, you also mentioned that somebody wanted to build another park, and you were pretty dubious about that.
We had the opportunity to have some ground given to us if we would make it a park. And we have a very nice park on the east end of Main Street, and there was some thought, do we need another one? For the people, it would be down on the south part of Ziering. And we went ahead with it, and it's turned out to be much better and much more popular than we anticipated. We've got playground equipment down there. There's been volunteers came in, and we've put up a shelter house down there. And we're working now on the idea and the plan of next spring starting in to put a restroom facility down there at that park. So it's turned out very well, and we have part of our frisbee golf course is now down at that park also.
But you are almost adjacent to the Dakins Lake Park. In fact, I saw something about some group in Ziering was going to be having their event over at Dakins Lake Park in the
yes.
campground.
Yes, and that's used over there. The shelter house, there's quite a few different things. Families that will have a reunion or a picnic, and they have used that shelter house over there now that the Dakins Lake project is completed. And so we actually have three areas you could call parks, but that there are activities that go on at that shelter house at Dakins Lake, yes.
Now, does Dakins Lake attract any business to businesses in Ziering?
Oh, yes. I think it'd be wrong to say no. You know, it's a general rule of thumb. Whenever you have traffic or people, that creates business. You know, if you have people coming and going or traffic from people, there's a certain amount of business and that's established from that. And I think our convenience store downtown realizes some of that. I'm sure it does. Yes.
Well, thank you. It's really, I think, one of the goals of our Local Talk Wednesday program is to find out what makes small towns, especially really small towns in central Iowa, successful. And it's interesting to me how different their stories are. And Zering has its own unique story, and I'm very happy to have had a chance to present this to our listeners here at KHOI, and thank you, Mayor, here for coming in.
Well, thank you, and yes, it takes to do it. It definitely takes a lot of effort and caring by several people to make things like this work, and we seem to have that here.
Well, congratulations.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You bet. Goodbye.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and we've heard from Martin here of Zering, giving us a glimpse of the recent Zering Days Festival and the history of this proud town. Before we go to the ledges to talk with Marlene Erzman about the Iowa Wildlife Center, let's break for a phonology of creatures we may have at home. Here's Patch Larbaum to tell us about crickets.
Phonology is recording nature's happenings when they occur. The first singing cicada of summer or the last monarch butterfly in autumn are noted in a journal for future reference and comparisons from year to year. And as Lee Searles of Marshalltown writes, phonology is the study of natural cycles in the lives of living animals and plants. Today's phonology is about crickets. House crickets get their common name from the fact that they often enter houses where they can survive indefinitely. This cricket species was introduced from Europe and is now found throughout the United States, but primarily east of the Rocky Mountains. The word cricket comes from the old French word criquet and refers to the cricket's song. People once thought that those repeated chirps sounded like criquet, criquet, criquet. Interestingly, the name for the sport of cricket has a totally different origin. It comes from an old French word for gold post. But outside, house crickets feed on plants and dead or live insects, including other crickets. Indoors, they can feed on fabric, including clothing and carpet, wool, cotton, silk, and synthetic fabrics, as well as clothes soiled with perspiration, are especially attractive to house crickets. There's a persistent myth that crickets rub their legs together to make sound. In fact, they sing with their wings. Run your finger down the teeth of a comb and you'll hear an almost musical rattle. Crickets make sound in a similar way. They rub a scraping organ on one wing against a comb-like organ on the other. Each cricket species has distinctive noise-making structures that produce unique sounds. Scientists have even managed to recreate the sound of an extinct cricket relative, a fossilized Jurassic bush cricket, or katydid, by examining the shape of its wings. That cricket in your house that's endlessly chirping away, it's probably a male. Most female crickets lack those sound-making wing structures. And so why do male crickets usually chirp? It's all about securing a mate. But crickets don't just sing a pretty song and wait for the admirers to trickle in. Many of them have a whole repertoire of calls. There's one for attracting females from afar, another for close-up courtship, and even a triumphal after-mating song. Crickets also sing to intimidate rival males, and some of a male's more romantic tunes may trigger nearby females to fight each other. crickets call more frequently when the weather gets hotter, it's such a proven phenomenon that you can use it to calculate the temperature. The Old Farmer's Almanac recommends that you can count the number of chirps in 14 seconds and add 40 to get the temperature in Fahrenheit. Insects have ears in weird places. Those cricket-eating parasitic flies, for example, have ears just below the head and neck. When a butterfly lands and folds up its wings, it's exposing its ears. And cricket ears are tiny spots, such a fraction of a millimeter long, on their front legs just below the knees. They're some of the smallest ears of any animal, but they're highly sensitive. One group of cricket relatives is the mole cricket. These insects have big claws and live underground. To attract mates, they throw little rock concerts. They dig horn-shaped burrows, turning their homes into amplifiers that make their calls extra loud. Insects often get a bad rap, but people of many cultures adore crickets. Chinese people have long kept these insects as good luck charms and for cricket-on-cricket battles. Crickets are beloved in Japan, especially for their musical songs. In Brazil, some species are considered to be a sign of hope or incoming wealth, though others are thought to be omens of illness and death. Fortunately, these household crickets are mostly harmless. Their poop may stain the curtains, and in rare cases they'll nibble clothing, but usually the worst they'll do is annoy you with their incessant calls. Imagine a high-protein food that's packed with vitamins. It's more efficient to produce than conventional meats, and it generates way less greenhouse gases. This superfood? Yep, it's crickets. You can now purchase these insects in a variety of forms, including flour. If Westerners can overcome their squeamishness about eating insects, then crickets just may be the future of food. And that is our phonology for today about crickets. Theme music is from John Barleycorn, Must Die by Traffic. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. Become a member or find the donate button at the website khoifm.org. This environmental update is sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, Story County's Conservation's Friends Group, working to enhance outdoor recreation, education, and conservation. Information can be found at oasco.org.
Thanks, Pat, for those amazing facts about crickets. And if you're curious about what crickets taste like, there is a booth at the Ames Farmers Market, but put on by Jim Nee Eat Crickets. And when I was there, there was a big long line of people lining up for their I'm not sure whether they were going to buy their cricket protein bars, but they were at least curious. Our next guest is Marlene Ehrsman, director of the Iowa Wildlife Center. Thank you for coming in today, Marlene.
Thank you for having me.
I think there's a little confusion, at least in my mind, about exactly where the center is located.
Okay. Well, that I'm sure it's a little confusing. We own 75 acres of land just south of the Ledges State Park and in Boone County. But until we get our facility built, we have been renting a space down on Main Street here in Ames. So a lot of our work is centered in the Ames community, and it always will be, even when we move out to the Boone Center.
And is that where people can bring wounded animals or birds?
Yes, and we always tell people, don't just drop them off. You need to call and make arrangements, because we don't have facilities, as you might imagine, on Main Street for every kind of animal. So, yeah, making sure that we can handle the species is important, and making sure the animal needs help is really the first and foremost to make sure about.
And what animals do you get the most of?
Well, the ones that we can handle would be the smaller ones, of course. And so we get in a lot of bats are one of our specialties. Bats of we have 9 species of bats here in Iowa, and we raised hoary bat pups and red bat pups and big brown bat pups this summer, and have been getting them released in the last couple of weeks. So bats are a pretty common thing for us to get in. We just got one in yesterday from Marshalltown that had a broken forearm. So that's pretty important when a bat has a broken arm, because that's how that's their wing. You know, their hand and their forearm is their wing. So getting that healed, and hopefully it'll be able to fly again. So bats, certainly one of our main species, but turtles, snakes, we've had skunks and possums and squirrels and rabbits and things like that. Hawks, owls. Yeah, so robins, bluebirds.
So songbirds, too.
Songbirds, too.
I noticed on your Facebook page, I guess, talking about a warning for people to be aware that their cats would be hunting.
Right, yes. And we've started a new initiative here in central Iowa with Ames Animal Shelter, and it's a catio initiative, and we can come in and talk about that later as we get it up and running. But we really want people to understand the damage that free-roaming cats do. Even though Ames has a leash law for cats and dogs, I think it's important that people know that we have alternatives to just letting our cats run free.
You said you are building something, and I learned this last week at the Ledges. So what will you have at the Ledges?
Well, we've been building several things over the last several years out on our property, which we call Wildway. The first thing that we got up was a 40 by 100 steel arch building, and that is still in progress. It's enclosed. We've got a put the amenities in it, the electrical and mechanical, and build our interior office space. That will be our temporary housing for the offices and some of the animal care until we get our main facility built. But other than that, we've been building several outdoor cages. Caging for a lot of these species is really specialized with the materials and the size depending on the animal. So you can imagine that the difference between what a coyote might take versus what a squirrel would take. One is certainly an arboreal or tree species, and the other one is a ground species, which needs much bigger caging. So we've been building those and raising money to do that as well.
Well, when those cages are finished, will they be out in the open so that people can come and look at the animals without bringing in wild animals?
No. We're going to have an exhibit out there for people to see animals up close. Those would be animals that cannot be released for various reasons, where they can't fly or we've gotten some, if we get a mammal in that is blind or something like that, and if it's suitable for captivity, some of these animals just will never be happy in captivity. If an animal is not, euthanasia is something that we always have to face. But we can have an exhibit of some of these animals that are can be fairly content in captivity for people to see, because we can't allow people in to just look at our patients, because these are wild animals. They're already stressed out. They've been injured. They've been sick. They've been abandoned, orphaned, whatever. And we're trying to keep them wild and keep them stress-free. So it's like a hospital zone for humans, and so they don't allow visitors roaming through the halls there. So the short answer is no, but we'll offer alternatives to get people behind the scenes.
Well, what are some animals that are happy in captivity and some that can't stand it?
Well, some of the higher-stress animals... cottontail rabbits, actually, you would think that would be a real easy thing to keep in captivity because they're small, they eat, they're herbivores, and they eat our gardens, but it's not, they're really a high-stress animal. They're a prey species, so you can imagine, they see us as prey. So So it really stresses them out, and they can, the adults can die pretty easily in captivity. So they would never really make a good captive animal unless you have really particular situations, very hands-off. So some of the flying animals, like the erixipiters, which are a type of, like a Cooper's hawk or something, they're very high stress, and a lot of them don't make good captive animals either. So right now in captivity, we have a snapping turtle. A lot of the turtle species do pretty well as long as you give them enough room and the right food and the right warmth, things like that, the right diet. They can stay pretty happy and healthy in captivity. At least that's what we observe. You know, we never really know what these animals are thinking. It's like, we hope they're happy, and if they're not, if they're healthy, we can assume that they're not super stressed, and they're having their needs fulfilled. So that's our goal, is to make sure these animals are happy and healthy.
And you may have explained it, but I'm not sure. What's the criteria for not releasing them into the wild? Do they still have something? What is that?
Okay, so it depends on the species again. So, for example, a turtle, sometimes we get turtles in, and if we know where they've come from, then we can. We always like to put animals back where they came from. So we're really careful about that for a lot of reasons. Animals know where their homes are, so they're most comfortable being released back into their homes. Otherwise, they can search. Turtles will travel up to 60 miles to return home, they have found in radio telemetry studies. So you'd think that just taking a turtle and plunking it in any old pond, if it's a pond turtle, would be a fine thing to do, but it's not. So as long as we know where they came from, that makes things a lot easier. Turtles, for example, a reason we wouldn't want to release a turtle might be that it has lost one limb. And they have, yes, they have four legs, and many animals get by on three legs pretty easily. But turtles, if they're an aquatic turtle, they have to haul themselves up on logs to bask because they're an ectothermic species, which means they get their warmth from their surroundings. So they cool down or warm up based on the temperature of their surroundings. And so to warm up, they have to haul themselves out of the water and up on logs. If they're missing a front leg, for example, they can't do that, at least not very easily. And so they have to go through some pretty rigorous tests about if they can haul themselves up and do all the normal activities to be able to survive in the wild. So an owl might come in blind, in one eye, and then you think, well, an owl hunts mostly by hearing, so maybe we could release it. On the other hand, they've lost depth perception, which is still pretty important to them as they're flying at night through the trees. So we have a lot of things to consider.
And how do you make those determinations? Do you have other experts, or do you?
We do rely on. I've always relied on my collaboration with other experts, whether here in the Ames community or throughout the state or throughout the nation. I have a vast network of experts that I can always turn to. But in many of the situations, and as a wildlife biologist and a wildlife rehabilitator, I understand a lot of the natural history of these species. And if I don't, if a new species comes in, like a bobcat or something, I will make sure that I call the experts and find out as much as I can about what they need to do to survive in the wild. And then I make the determination. So I have my birthday's today. I just turned 67. And so I have a long history of doing this. And so I've learned a lot, Susan, over the years. And so I can bring some of that wisdom to bear in these cases.
Well, I have a question from my first years in Ames, which were the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, they do something that they no longer do at the Ledges. They had pens for healthy animals.
Yes.
That they had that were like, it was like a zoo from the Ledges. Mm-hmm. And they had a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have wolves ever?
No, we've never gotten a wolf in. And that's one thing. I'll go back to that exhibit in a minute, but one thing that we want to be prepared for as the Iowa Wildlife Center is taking in species that no other rehabilitator can take in because they don't have the expertise, they don't have the space, they don't have the money. This is a really expensive endeavor where they don't have the knowledge and skills, and so we want to be able to fill in all those gaps with all those other species. A lot of rehabilitators take in primarily your cottontails and your squirrels. Those are the mostly cottontails and squirrels seem to be the number one and two animal we get calls about. So raccoons, you know, things like that. But we will have the space and the expertise, and hopefully the funding will follow to be prepared to take in things like the occasional wolf that we would all love, I think, to see return to the state, black bears. Cougars, if they, you know, get into trouble and as they're passing through the state, or maybe taking up residence here. You know, there are a lot of species that I look forward to being able to help out with as we move forward.
You mentioned bobcats.
Yes.
Have you had a bobcat?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Last summer, a bobcat kitten. It didn't have its eyes open yet. It was just a few days old when we got it. The mother had given birth in the window well of a state park ranger's basement window, and she moved all the kittens but one the day after she gave birth, and he didn't know where she moved them to, and so he got a hold of us, because situations with newborns are pretty dire in that they're fed frequently. And all these animals have specialized diets, and so getting these animals to people with the knowledge of what that animal needs, the baby bobcat formula, who knew what that would require? So he got it up to us, and then I raised it for a month and then transferred it on up to another facility that had other bobcat kittens so it would be raised with its own kind. It was really important to do that.
Well, that's a... You may have many fascinating stories.
There are a lot of stories. Yes, yes.
And will the Ledges Center be open?
Well, we would. We've always said yesterday we'd love to have had it open yesterday or last year or whatever. But we really have been focusing this summer and throughout this next year on stewarding Wildway and doing some restoration and building more cages, but also working on this building. So hopefully in the next year we can get moved out there. We always want to have an Ames presence, a smaller office maybe for drop-offs. We don't know what that'll look like yet, but we always want to stay connected to the Ames community. One thing I was going to mention about you mentioned the exhibit out at the Boone Wildlife Research Station at the Ledges years ago. My husband was the last manager of that exhibit before it closed down. And then he just retired after a 41-year career with the DNR in the Wildlife Diversity Program. But he managed it. So I know that wolf you were talking about. And he does too, because it bit him.
Oh.
Yes, yes. These animals are wild animals, you know, and we have to understand that even if they're in captivity, they're not pets. And even if people bring them into their homes and think they're going to raise them, they're not pets, Susan. They're wild animals, and all their wild instincts will come to pass, even if you've raised it as a youngster.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
Very interesting visit to the Wildlife Center with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, look forward to doing it in the future. And we have a song for us, the transition. So could you play it, please?
All things come and all things go. Seeds all fly when the strong winds blow. I wanna be somebody. I wanna have my day. I wanna go somewhere, somehow I'm gonna find my way. And the earth turns, tides flow, geese fly, grass grows, tadpoles change in the blink of an eye. They're croaking and a-singing to a moonlit sky. Sing it to the world that they're all here. Dig into the mud when the fall comes near. And now it's time to go away. I'll be back another day. I wanna be somebody. Somewhere, somehow, I'm gonna find my way. Like a leaf flies pushed on soft summer breeze. Sticking to the screen doors, clinging to the trees. Flying by the water on a hot summer day. The world turns once, they all go away. Around the porch lights, all night long. I'm enough for one sweet song. I wanna be somebody. I want to have my day. I want to go somewhere, somehow. I'm going to find my way. Like sparks jumping out of a fire, they're squeaking through the night. Try to get a little higher. Brighter than a lightning bolt, faster than a minute. Stole a piece of the night and lit it. Hottest fires quickly burn, for the flame is gone. I wanna be somebody. I wanna have my day. I wanna go somewhere, somehow. I'm gonna find my way. Like a windstorm screaming through the town, knocking over trees, gonna blow your doors down, rolling over fields, blow itself gone. There's time enough for one last song. All things come and all things go. Seeds all fly when strong. I wanna be somebody. I wanna have my day. I wanna go somewhere, somehow. I'm gonna find my way. Like tadpoles changing the blink of an eye. Croaking and singing to a moonlit sky. Singing to the world that they're all here. Dig into the mud when the fall comes near. Like a leaf flies pushed on a soft summer tree. Sticking to the screen doors, clinging to the trees. Flying by the water on a hot summer's day. The world turns once, they all go away. Sparks jumping out of a fire, screaming through the night. Try to get a little higher, brighter than a lightning bolt, faster than a minute. Stole a piece of the night and lit it like a windstorm. Screaming through the town, knocking over trees, gonna blow your doors down. Rolling over fields, blow itself gone. There's time enough for one last song. All things come, all things go. Seeds all fly when strong winds blow. All things come, all things go. Seeds all fly when strong winds blow. All things come, all things go. Seeds all fly when strong winds blow.
You just heard Mayflies by Reggie Greenlaw, which is a fitting introduction to the topic with which we're ending the program, butterflies. And we have Donald Lewis, extension entomologist, to talk with us about how the fragile insects prepare for the coming winter.
Good morning, Susan. There's a lot to talk about when you bring in insects into the conversation, and we've had just such a great summer of butterfly watching because of the large numbers of painted ladies. We're now seeing the monarchs. The tiger swallowtails are in your backyard or in the prairie that you're visiting. So there's just been a lot of butterfly activity going on. And if you think ahead, what's going to happen to those butterflies when the temperatures get cold and when the snows are flying?
Yes. And you know, right?
Well, we know some. And surviving an Iowa winter takes some sort of a trick that you just can't wait it out. You have to have some mechanism of surviving those temperatures that are likely to be very far below freezing. And if you don't have a mechanism for protecting yourself from ice formation in the fluids of your body, in the plant, in the insect, will be fatal. So we have to have a mechanism for that. We have to have a mechanism for getting out of the weather. And it varies with each species. So this process of going into a, or preparing to go into a state of inactivity to survive an inhospitable condition is called diapause in biology. And it varies with each insect how they get into diapause, at what time they go into diapause. But we know those shortening day lengths and those changes in temperatures and changes in moisture levels in the fall of the year help those insects protect themselves, get themselves into a condition to be protected. Well, it varies with each butterfly. And some butterflies make it through the winter as adults. They just lay out there under the leaf litter. They may be hidden in a wood pile. And the butterfly makes it through the winter just waiting in the adult stage. More common, they either wait in the caterpillar or the chrysalis stage. The chrysalis is the pupa where they're transforming. And then there are those examples that are probably the best known to us, and that is butterflies that don't survive winters in Iowa. They go south, and that would include the monarchs that we know well and know a lot about because of their migration to Mexico every year. It also includes the painted lady, that the butterfly that was so common earlier this summer. They just go further south in the United States to where they can escape the weather, and it also the red admiral and a couple of others. So lots of ways to make it through an Iowa winter, including not staying here at all.
Well, the question that I would have is about monarchs. You keep reading that they have generations before they get back to Mexico. So what happens in those generations?
What happens in those generations is the genetic material that leads butterflies to migrate when the days are short is preserved. That genetic material that was in the ancestral butterflies that made it to Mexico and survived was replicated and reproduced in following generations. That then is shared with the next generation and the next generation. So you're right. The butterflies that leave Mexico in February, the monarch butterflies that start flying south and north in February, only get as far as northern Mexico or Texas when they reproduce. So there's a spring generation further south of us, and we start seeing monarchs by April. Sometimes it's not until quite almost May. But in April and May, we see the monarchs that are the offspring of the ones who hibernated. They reproduce two or three times here in Iowa. And now that we're at the last generation of monarchs, those adult monarchs that are emerging now are experiencing much shorter day lengths, they're experiencing cooler temperatures, and their genetically driven innate behavior is to start flying south. And they will keep flying south for 2,000 miles to a place where their great-great-grandparents or their great-great-great-grandparents spent the winter, and they will do it themselves to perpetuate the species.
Is that unique with monarchs?
That far of a distance of migration and then the return and the subsequent generations is unique to North America. There may be other examples of long-distance migration in other parts of the world, but for us, monarchs that are now emerging as adult butterflies in Canada will be in Mexico by October. And that 2,000, 3,000-mile migration includes almost all of the butterflies from the eastern two-thirds of the United States. All the monarch butterflies east of the Rocky Mountains are going to be down there in Mexico. The shorter migrations that we talked about with the painted lady butterflies, and that was the orange and black and white butterfly that we saw in May in great numbers. We saw them in great numbers in June. We saw the third generation, the third batch of adults in July. They are now thistle caterpillars out there eating thistles, nettles, and soybean leaves. When those adults emerge here in another week or so, they will also have the genetically programmed innate ability to fly south when the temperatures reach a certain level or when the day lengths shorten to such a point. And they will survive by escaping the freezing cold weather. For both the monarchs and the painted ladies, the ones that stay here, the ones that emerge too late to get out of the state, the ones that get caught by an early frost, by an early freeze, they will perish. They won't get to perpetuate the species. They won't get to reproduce because they will die here rather than get to a place where they can survive.
I read earlier that this was a good year for the monarchs in Mexico, that there were more than there had been. Was there any explanation for that?
You know, it's a big, complicated story because we're talking about all of the eastern two-thirds of North America. We're talking from the Rocky Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean. We're talking from Louisiana up into Canada. And we have to produce a bumper crop of monarchs here in our summer to send a huge population, millions and millions, tens of millions of butterflies, to a mountain peak in south central Mexico that's at about 9,000 feet above sea level, where the humidity is just right, the temperature is just right for the monarch butterfly to hibernate. So it starts with great reproduction up here. And of course, that requires lots of milkweed because that's the food source of the monarch caterpillar. Then they get to Mexico, they have to escape through ice storms and mudslides and illegal logging. One of the problems that the Mexican government has pretty well taken care of is logging in those areas of the monarch butterfly ruin the habitat where they can hibernate. So we have to protect them through all of that. And then they have to turn around and fly north to Mexico and southern Texas, where again they need to find milkweeds in order to reproduce. Every step of that is important, and to say, well, it was one of those, it may not be quite right. But compared to the monarch populations of the 1970s, early 1980s, we are at a small fraction of what we used to have. But the encouraging news is between the winter of 2015 and 2016 to the winter of 2017 and 2018, the number of monarchs in Mexico did increase. So we grab onto each of those little pieces of good news and we hold it tight.
Well, I think that's a great way to end our hour, unless you have a final word of encouragement or...
Well, summer's coming to a close, and with all the fall blooming flowers, it's easy to see butterflies, especially at slightly cooler temperatures. They're very active when it's 90 degrees, but now that the daytime temperatures are 70s, it's great to see them. So find a prairie like the Doolittle Prairie up near Story City or the Prairie Remnant that's out at the Iowa Arboretum. Find a prairie or a natural area that's got a lot of flowering plants this time of the year and get out and enjoy these fall days by watching the butterflies while we still have them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
That was Donald Lewis, extension entomologist. This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host for today, Susan Franzen. Other voices you heard were Martin Heer, Pat Schlarbaum, Marlene Erschmann, and Donald Lewis. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you'll also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Mayflies by Reggie Greenlaw. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.